Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Primary day is tomorrow. There's the Columbus Zoo levy in a three-way race in the home district of the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, among other things. Joining us for our weekly reporters roundtable to hash it all out in the studio is Bloomberg News reporter Mark Niquette. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Always good to be on.
And joining us by phone, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, everybody.
If anybody has a question or comment, state government, politics, you name it, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Daryl, the Columbus Zoo levy is a big deal in Franklin County and in Delaware County, apparently, because there was polling there as well. But a poll last week suggested that the Columbus Zoo levy is poised for defeat. The poll had the levy down by 20 points. Can you tell us more about this polling outfit and how it differs from, say, a lot of the polls that you've done over the past several years?
Sure. And let me say first, Ann, that I'm a little in an awkward position. Our marketing director at the Dispatch is on the Zoo levy board and is heading the campaign. So just with that disclaimer out there for all my comments, I'll try to play it straight down the middle. SurveyUSA took the poll that showed the levy being defeated by 20 points in Franklin County. SurveyUSA, again, that may be exactly right, but their methodology is one that is generally not accepted among most pollsters. That's what we call robocalls. In other words, a computer calls your phone, you punch buttons in response, and then those responses are added up. And plus, their margin of error is a little bit high as well. Now, again, even you could say that even a methodology, it's not generally accepted, 20-point margin, that's still pretty impressive.
So it could be that they're close, or they're the 20 points, meaning five, or the margin of error is five percentage points up or down.
Right, plus or minus. So, so in theory, with margin of error, it could be 10, because you add five to one side and take five away from the other side. So it swings 10 points. But still, 10 points, or hey, if you're losing by one vote, you're losing, right?
So, Karen Kassler, what do you make of this, what is looking like a pretty sound defeat of the levy tomorrow?
Well, it reminds me a little bit of the levy campaign that was going on in Westerville, I don't know, a year or so ago. This campaign that kind of built over social media and then has really gained steam over the last couple of weeks. I mean, you've seen a couple of signs, yard signs, and a lot of them seem to be hooked on this whole thing of a third zoo. And, you know, the people who are backing the levy have said over and over that this is not a third zoo levy, that only a portion of this goes to help fund the facility that would be in the downtown Columbus area. But I think that's what a lot of people are hinging on. It's not just the Delaware County issue, the idea that Franklin County residents are paying for this and are not getting any sort of benefit other than I think there's reduced admission for Franklin County residents on Wednesday. But this idea of a third zoo, and a lot of folks seem to have a real concern with that. And I think that's if there's any fault that the levy backers have had, it's really addressing that and getting ahead of that issue, because that seems to be driving a lot of the anti-vote.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark Niquette, it's also a complicated levy. I mean, the money's not complicated. You know that what goes to the zoo from your property taxes, say per $100,000, roughly doubles to about $41 or $42, something like that. But there are so many things that they're saying they're going to buy with this money. When they get complicated like that, kind of like the Columbus Schools levy, too, a lot of stuff. Does that affect, do you think that affects voters?
I think it can. And just off the bat, like Daryl, in full disclosure, I am a zoo member, and I have, I've said this before, I have pictures of the lion cubs and the tiger cubs. I'm a big zoo supporter. But I think part of the problem is you have sort of any kind of tax levy, it's easy to vote no. You don't need much, put it this way, to vote no. So in this case, when you have, like Karen was saying, this question about, you know, do we really need this money allocated to an auxiliary zoo in Franklin County? And as you're saying, you know, maybe some questions or confusion about, okay, how is this all money being spent? There's this piece of it that has the elimination of the 12.5% rollback and how that affects the money. Sometimes it's easy just to vote no when there's any kind of question about a tax levy, even on an issue like this, where I think there's genuine goodwill. I mean, I think people like the zoo. They want to support the zoo generally. But when it comes to doubling the amount of the tax and the questions that surround it, it is a hurdle, I think, that this particular issue had to face.
Plus, what about putting it on the primary ballot? Daryl, we're not going to have a lot of turnout, so who's most likely to turn out?
Well, you know, I have two schools of thought on that, and that's, you know, it's usually the ardent voters on both sides. I don't really have a feel for just, you know, the zoo levy. I'm sure there's ardent supporters out there. Are the opponents quite as ardent? You know, typically Republican voters are more apt to turn out to vote, but how does that play in, you know, within these dynamics? There is no Republican gubernatorial primary. There is in the Democratic Party, but it's not much of a contest, right? Right, right. So, you know, and then there's, you know, various local issues in various communities. So turnout's going to be low. So, yeah, something crazy could happen because you got a lot of people talking about this issue, but it's you know, who has voted already and then mm-hmm. who will, you know, show up tomorrow to complete the ballot.
Well, and I wonder, too, if that's not why the levy's on the ballot when it is. I mean, these levies are planned quite a long time in advance, and they're not put on the ballot by accident. And I wonder if there might not have been a thought of, well, this is probably not going to be a big turnout levy, and maybe the opposition, nobody saw the opposition coming and thought this was going to be either something very simple or maybe it's a trial run. Maybe it's just to see what might happen if there's opposition to this with this third facility. Maybe there will be another zoo levy in the next couple of months or years that would approach things a little bit differently. It's interesting to consider that question.
That's a good point, Karen. And I know there's been extensive private polling on this, so they are not just, you know, throwing darts at a dartboard and say, oh, I guess May primary wins out here. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of research, and as Karen says, on a lot of these various options. You know, the fact that this is a permanent tax, unlike the previous zoo levies, you know, that's another factor that makes this one different. And so that could make the outcome different.
Speaking of not seeing the opposition coming, did anybody see the Koch brothers' involvement by way of Prosperity for America? And what, have they dumped something like $300,000 into the opposition campaign, Daryl? I mean, is this going to be more typical going forward, do you think? Or
I think we are seeing this. The Americans
they have billions to spend.
Well, I was going to say, it must be nice to have it, I guess. it's interesting. You want to spread your influence down to this, you know, almost a micro level here.
Right.
Although a better example may be they were involved in a Gahanna tax issue in, mm-hmm. in the last election.
Right.
So, you know, you're getting down to communities of, you know, just a few tens of thousands.
Now, Prosperity for America, they have an office in Ohio. It's not, I mean, we keep saying they're coming out of another state, but they do have an office here. They've been here for a couple of years.
Right.
You know, I think this is one of the perks, one of the downfalls of being a swing state. I mean, I think some of these groups are really starting to look at Ohio as a place where they want to have a permanent presence and not just parachute in every 4 years. And I think it's on both sides, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, or the progressive and conservative side. And so I think that this is the kind of thing that is exactly what activists on both sides of the spectrum would get involved in when there's a concern. And so I wasn't surprised at all, personally.
Yeah, and there are chapters of Americans for Prosperity all over the country, and you have been seeing them get involved in local issues. They got involved in a transit issue in Tennessee. They got involved in local races. So it's not just, you know, the big presidential race we all think of, or where, you know, the Koch brothers would be involved. And I think it's the idea they have, can have an impact at the lower level where they can really matter. But I guess I was a little surprised to see it get down to a zoo levy. I mean, I know it's a tax issue, it's spending,
big zoo levy.
But it's a zoo levy, right? We're not right. talking about, you know, any kind of partisan advantage.
But it made national news. I mean, I would say it's front page in the Washington Post, but there's been little notes about it.
And this is the Columbus Zoo, I mean, we talk about the zoo being one of the best zoos in the country and Jack Hanna being a national figure and this kind of stuff. So in a way, maybe it's not surprising that, that our zoo does make headlines and makes lists of places to see across the country, that this is just exactly the kind of thing that a group like Americans for Prosperity would get involved in, because it is such a figure, an iconic place in a key battleground state.
Keith in Columbus, you're on the air. You have a theory. What? Tell us. Hi, Keith.
Yes.
You're on the air. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My comment's really simple. I listen to NPR pretty regularly, and, you know, I have never heard anyone on any of the shows over the last, you know, month talk about the other side of the issue, which is why we shouldn't do this.
Well, I had a whole show on it. What do you mean?
Wait, a cotton picking minute. It was all swayed towards the side of why we should do the zoo levy. I'm just tired of taxes, and you don't bring that up. I'm tired of more taxes on more taxes on more taxes. And it doesn't have to do with whether it's a great idea. I have a season pass every year to the zoo, so I support the zoo avidly. But I don't want more taxes, and I certainly don't want a permanent tax. And because there's very little coverage for this side of the issue, you wonder why people like the Koch brothers get involved, because there's no other voice to the people that don't want more taxes.
Would you have voted to renew the current tax? Were you okay with that?
It's already there, and it's already built into my budget, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't probably have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks, Keith. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Take care. Dave in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I kind of follow the gentleman ahead of me, except I would not vote for another tax. I agree that it should not be a forever tax and doubling it. We are all, those of us that pay taxes are just being bent over, and enough's enough. We don't need a facility downtown. I don't care how wonderful it'd be. I don't agree with that. Jack Hanna gets on TV and markets it, but he still gets a screaming large emeritus salary. He's not doing that for free. And yes, we have a wonderful zoo, but it needs to function as a park as it does. If Disney, you want to go there? $100 a day. The zoo's a great deal, and we are sustaining members also. But instead of going to the taxpayer to double up what they already pay, I feel that either you need to make it free for everybody in Franklin County because we're paying, or raise the dues, raise the cost of people that use it. And I agree. I don't think it's been the other side has been well represented.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Dave.
Yep.
Take care.
Hmm.
Yep.
I think it's interesting to hear people talking about how the other side isn't well represented, because I've heard both sides all over the place. I've heard it on your show, Ann. I've heard it on TV. I've seen it on social media. I'm surprised that both sides don't feel like their message is getting out there, because it seems to be everywhere.
Well, I just will leave it at that, and we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Mark Niket of the Bloomberg News, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, and Kieran Kassler of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We're moving on now to the Tom Noe report that was released by the Inspector General for the state of Ohio last week. It was released, and then there was a problem. It turned out that five people's names were missing from the report that goes back to the CoinGate investigation some, 9 years ago. Okay. And it turns out that they mistakenly thought that five people had whose records had been expunged in connection with the case. And so that required Daryl Rowland to write another story the next day and other reporters around the state. Daryl, first tell us about CoinGate. Give us a recap. Or I guess, Mark Niket, why don't you give us a recap of CoinGate and, plumb your memory banks there.
Well, CoinGate, as people might remember, all had to do with Tom Noe, who was a big Republican contributor in Toledo, was involved in Republican politics, was head of the Republican Party. Was he head of the party when you were covering up there? Yeah. So he's a big influential Republican donor, and he has a rare coin business. This is sort of his thing. He sells rare coins and Beanie Babies and all kinds of collectibles, and he gets the Bureau of Workers' Compensation to invest $50 million in rare coins. And the short of it was coins come up missing, the records all turn out to be questionable.
Well, they give him $50
million. $50 million, right, to invest and to ostensibly buy rare coins as an investment for the Bureau that would appreciate and make money for the Bureau, but it never happens. And he gets convicted of theft, money goes missing. We find out that another Bureau investor lost money, and he gets convicted too, Mark Lay, so he's in prison. So we have two people in prison as a result of this. And the Bureau has a whole kind of restructuring of its board and policies for investments and so forth. And to get up to speed with where we are today, there was a whole set of prosecutions related to this investigation, and it was a task force kind of investigation. You had federal officials involved, you had state officials, including the inspector general, and they ran its course. They pursued their investigations. They had their charges brought and trials if necessary. But at the end of the day, there never was a final inspector general's report. Typically, when you have an investigation like this, you get a final report from the inspector general that includes, you know, supplemental materials like the interviews that were conducted that you can go look at, and sort of wraps up what happened. And the Democrats in particular, and Chris Redfern, the Democratic chairman in Ohio in particular, you know, complained loud and long that there never was a final report from the inspector general on CoinGate.
Would that have been Tom Charles at the time?
It was.
Okay.
And even after Tom Charles left office and was replaced by Randy Meyer, there was still continued calls for a final CoinGate report. Well, we finally got that report last week, and ultimately it didn't tell you anything you didn't know. Essentially, it just recapped what had been done, who had been charged, and, you know, what had been changed at the Bureau, was sort of with a conclusion that, you know, hey, things are better now. And the explanation was, well, this had already been investigated. We're not going to spend new time and new resources to reinvestigate any of this. So here's just, you know, somebody complained it was just a book report, something you could Google and get the
book
information.
Book report without citations is, I think, the way Chris Redfern put it.
Catherine Tercer.
Okay. So, Darrell Rowland, it didn't tell anybody anything new, but it also left out some things that people did know. That's five names of people who had been convicted.
Right. One of the interesting things, shall we say, about this report is that the inspector general and his assistants admitted right away they did not have the background material to do, shall we say, a complete investigation, even if they wanted to. First of all, there's been 100% personnel change in that office since Tom Charles's day. There's not a single person who was actually in part of the Noe investigation who's still in that same office. So that's number one. Number two, in that joint task force that Mark talked about, again, state, federal, and local investigators, there was some special status granted by the feds, federal evidence rules where local officials are given special permission to see some federal evidence, things that went before the grand jury, even grand jury testimony in some cases, as part of the investigation and prosecution of these cases. Well, this is the new guy. He doesn't have any of those special permissions. According to him, he was denied it when he asked for it. So there's a whole cadre of evidence out there that he did not even see. So his philosophy was, let's just take it from this, you know, from when we left off the prosecutions to now, look at all the recommendations and reports, and, you know, how did that come to today? Now, the other thing he could not include was information about records that had been expunged, criminal records. Well, who are they? Well, he can't say because he would be himself subject to prosecution, and that is right. That's under state law.
If
they're truly expunged. And the key point was, I said, well, okay, there's no prohibition against telling me how many is there. And they thought about it for a while, and they said, no. So they said, there's five. So, of course, then the scavenger hunt is on. And, you know, modest Mark Niket, who's sitting beside me, just like he did for years at the Dispatch, had done yeoman's work so I could go to school on his reporting for the time and his list. And five names bubbled up, including that of former Governor Bob Taft. And again, I bounced these names off these folks. Again, they're not confirming the actual names, but they're not warning me off. There was an odd moment where I checked electronically to see if I could find these in any court records. There were four locally and one in Lucas County. Couldn't find three of them, but Bob Taft and one, his former executive assistant, Doug Mormon's names were still accessible, as they are today, on the Franklin County Municipal Court's website. In other words, their criminal records are there. So I say to the inspector general, what's the deal? They've supposedly been expunged. They couldn't explain it. In fact, there was some talk about, well, maybe the clerk of courts is in trouble because she is putting expunged records out to the public. Well, I think as most of your listeners probably know now, it turned out that Bob Taft's records were not expunged. Doug Mormon's records were not expunged. They never asked for it, so obviously they never got it. I had not even called the prosecutor or anything because, again, they couldn't talk about it if they were expunged, so why even ask for confirmation? I talked to Governor Taft personally about, you know, I want to talk to you about your expunged records, you know. And he says, that's been a long time ago. I don't want to talk to it. I don't want to get into it. I ask him again. He says, well, I'm sorry. I'm not going to comment on that. I contacted Mr. Mormon by email. Again, how's life since your expungement? You know, and he talked a little bit about it, but he said he didn't want to be in the paper, so I didn't put in a paper. I'm not going to repeat it here. But neither one said one thing about, hey, what are you talking about, expungement? Again, that's not necessarily their responsibility, but wouldn't you think, yeah. Wait a minute. They both know me, especially Governor Taft. We worked, you know, I covered him way back in the 90s when he was Secretary of State.
Right.
So it just seems odd to me that it never came up. So we ran the story. Bob Taft's attorney calls me. Bill Meek said, now, how did you get the information again? So I went through it all again. He says, well, the governor doesn't think his records are expunged. It was weird to me. There was actually some doubt. So Mr. Meeks called Ron O'Brien, the Franklin County prosecutor. He called the city attorney's office. And indeed, they both confirmed that because they would have to give permission or at least be involved in any hearing. They both said, no Bob Taft. So we immediately did a web story. And I know the Blade was chasing us and AP was chasing us to confirm that story. Mm-hmm. Then they had to do a 180 as well, mm-hmm. how the expunged records weren't really expunged.
What does this say about the inspector general's office that these five people, the records of these five people were incorrectly reported or it's hard to say. They weren't reported at all. Obviously, the governor's role and what happened, that was historical back when it happened.
Right.
Kieran Kassler, I mean, does it say something about the inspector general's office, what it's supposed to do and the kind of, regard the public needs to have for it?
Well, I think, you know, when I look at this report, you know, I look at it in the light, this is terrible to say, of how the Toledo Blade was suing to try to get the report released.
In the first place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I just wondered, that was my first reaction, was this some sort of effort to try to deal with that suit? Because like Daryl was saying, I mean, the people have all changed. It's been almost a decade since this happened, which is hard to believe in my mind because I can remember this like it was yesterday. But it's been so long that a lot of folks, either a lot of voters, a lot of people who are concerned may not still be lingering at this point, that there were assumptions that were made after that happened and you know, everybody's moved on a little bit. And so the whole timing of the report was interesting, especially in an election year for it to come out. And obviously the Democrats have seized on it. Chris Redford called for Inspector General Randy Meyer to resign and other Democrats joined him in that. But, you know, the whole thing seems the timing of this is very, very weird to me.
It does make you wonder what actually happened in the inspector general's office, because mm-hmm. we were talking about this off the air, and we're not talking about advanced investigatory, you know, procedure here. This is not CSI to get these records. I mean, mm-hmm. it's sort of your basic starting point, right? What records are out there, you know, and go from there. So how does it that we think that there's not records, or we think that there's five expungements, and even as it started to unravel, why we still don't sort of come forward and say, well, you know, we did find the records and we were wrong and here's why.
Well, yeah, again, the explanation I was given is they just did their search very poorly, which was odd because I got hits the first time I tried. I suppose if you search under Robert Taft instead of Bob Taft, which he was known while he was governor, You might not have gotten a hit. It's J. Douglas Mormon. But if you know that, you're going to search. And again, I got the hit. Or, you know, do like any good journalist does and, you know, just search for the last name. There's not that many out there. It's not like it's Smith or Jones or something. Again, I don't want to be totally defensive here and come off like I'm without fault or anything here. You know, I feel horrible. I wrote a story that was ended up being totally inaccurate. First time in my career. That's not a good feeling. And it doesn't, you know, you can say, well, maybe it wasn't your fault or whatever, but you still go back and ask yourself, geez, what could I have done differently? Because I, you know, that's a pretty sacred trust with readers, and media credibility is certainly not that hot these days where we can just go printing a story, it turns out to be untrue. So the feeling of that, you know, when I talked to Bill Meeks and the realization started growing that, wait a minute, there was no expungement. I mean, that was horrible. And we corrected that just as quickly as we could.
It does make you wonder, I mean, why Tom Charles, the former inspector general, why he didn't follow up and get a report done in a timely manner after the convictions were settled and so forth.
Well, and that's this man right here, Mark Duquette, would ask him periodically.
Right. And I don't think he ever really came out and said that he wasn't going to do it. It just was one of those things where, you know, it was still...
There was
a suggestion that something was still being looked at, or at least there was still the possibility of something could come out. So it wasn't, you know, ripe for a final report. And then we had a transition where he ended up leaving and going over to Department of Public Safety. Mm-hmm. So there really wasn't sort of a definitive, we're not going to do it, or, you know, the time's going to run out at some point. It just sort of evolved this way. But the question all along was, you know, was there more to this? I mean, clearly, there was a whole range of prosecutions, including the governor's we've been talking about on that ethics violation. But, you know, there were all kinds of, you know, discussions and even some hints in the records that there was more to how NOAA got approved to get this $50 million to invest in rare coins. Mm-hmm. And was there other culpability? And the thought all along was, well, there might have been folks, actors who were involved whose names didn't come to light or who weren't prosecuted because you couldn't get to that bar of actually being able to make a case against someone.
And by the way, the whole thing started, the CoinGate investment plan, you know, project, started during the Voinovich administration.
Yes, in the late 90s. Well, in a way, you could start it
the second,
back it up
second
a,
term.
Yes, and you could even back it up a year or two earlier when the state law was changed to allow these sort of, I guess my word, not theirs, exotic investments. Because before you couldn't even do
something.
Okay.
Derivative? No.
Alternatives.
Ask the Bloomberg guy about this, right? But yeah, so there was mystery about how that law got changed, because without that law being changed, there would be no Tom Noe. Certainly the name Paul Mifsud, Governor Voinovich's chief of staff, campaign manager, and, you know, a very powerful man who, you know, has now been deceased for several years now. His name came up more than once. Again, in researching this, I went back and saw Mark's stories from 2005 and 2006, where sources told us it was Mifsud, and there were others saying this was greased from above. That they told reporters that. We don't have powers of subpoena or can bring people before grand jury, so that's why it's frustrating to hear that as reporters, and then it's like, did you ever check that out? And as Mark says, okay, maybe you couldn't get a charge for that, but what is to this day not released is those interviews. We can see, number one, was it even asked? Number two, was it asked, and what happened when it was asked? Mm-hmm. So that is still under wraps, and frankly, if that's in the pile that's regarded as secret because that went before a grand jury or something, Ohioans may never know, and I think that makes no one happy.
And that is what brings up my question of why the timing of this. There's so many things that were unanswered. Why put this out now? Why even bring all this up now?
Because of a lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that I can come back to. But, you know, if so much of this is still up in the air and still has a lot of questions attached to it, what was the point of putting this report out now?
Well, Karen, they were, I don't know if a suit was ever filed, but Common Cause certainly threatened litigation.
Sure.
And cited the law that actually does require a report to be prepared. So Tom Charles didn't do it, and Randy Meyer had not done it. But I know for a fact he's been working on this for a couple of years, so that, you know, the Blade lawsuit may have speeded things up, but it didn't generate the report, good or bad.
We will be talk when we return. We'll talk about six couples suing the state of Ohio to take down the ban on same-sex marriage. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. With me in the studio, Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, and Mark Niket, reporter for Bloomberg News. And also with us by telephone, Karen Kassler, chief of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Six couples have sued to overturn Ohio's same-sex marriage ban. Karen Kassler, we've been talking about this for weeks now. There have been other lawsuits out there that get kind of are chipping away at the ban, but this one is a full frontal opposition right to the ban. Tell us what makes it, I mean, why now, why this?
Well, this is the same group of attorneys that helped with the last lawsuit that was filed by the couples who wanted to be listed on their child's birth certificates. And they scored a win, these attorneys did and these couples did, when Judge Timothy Black said that, yes, they should be on the birth certificates, these same-sex couples, and that he went a little bit further and said that Ohio needs to recognize out-of-state same-sex marriages and said that Ohio's ban on that recognition should be overturned. Now, that's all stayed right now because the state is appealing that decision. Mm-hmm. Those families, though, are being permitted to list their names on the birth certificates. This is taking it one step further, kind of, as you said, and trying to go at the same-sex marriage ban from the 2004 ballot issue directly head on and saying that these are couples, same-sex couples that live in Ohio, they want to get married in Ohio, and they want to be treated as married couples in Ohio. And so this is probably the most direct, I think, attack on that amendment that was voted on in 2004 so far. But it's one of several things that's happening. I mean, you've got these lawsuits, you've got the possibility of a ballot issue, not this year now, but maybe next year or the year after that. And so there's a lot of movement going on this issue at a time when it's kind of interesting because the polls are showing about a 50-50 split. And the older the voter is, the more likely the voter is to be against same-sex marriage. So this is, for a lot of activists, not exactly the perfect time to start talking about putting it before voters. But then there are others who say, we've waited long enough for marriage equality. Now let's start talking about it and doing something.
The 50-50, what the polls are showing right now, assuming that they're accurate, is much better off, though, for the case for same-sex marriage in Ohio than it was in 2004.
Oh,
things
absolutely
have changed a lot.
Absolutely. But once again, the older the voter, the more likely the voter is to be against it. And that really makes a difference in an off-year election. And
because they're more likely to vote.
And they're more likely to be older voters. In presidential elections, right, they're more likely to be younger, they're more likely to be diverse. And so that's a big key here, I think.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, some people say, Daryl Rowland, that, you know, we voted on this in 2004 as a constitutional amendment. Just leave it alone. That's what the people voted for.
And I believe that is Governor Kasich.
That's what the governor
stands.
Said, yeah.
Right. Again, it doesn't matter what side of this issue you're on. If you look at the opinion polling at what has happened in this state and in this country, just this has been a sociological phenomenon in terms of a public opinion shift on this issue. It's just been incredible, you know, in the past decade. Again, you can hate it or love it. It has happened. And as you say, there's a rough equivalency now. Or as Karen said, again, we got two different things going on here. Well, one, we have a burgeoning, renewed petition effort to put this on the ballot, statewide ballot in 2016. Now we also have the legal challenge being filed in U.S. District Court. I think it's important to note, by the way, that this legal challenge, which is indeed the first head-on challenge, the previous ones were about birth certificates and death certificates. This goes to the heart of this says that constitutional amendment that Ohio passed in 2004 is itself unconstitutional, U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. But they have a different judge than the one that's been ruling on, and this judge is an appointee of George W. Bush as a former county Republican chairman. So whether he maybe as sympathetic as Judge Black, who, of course, was a Democratic candidate for the Ohio Supreme Court back in the day. That's an open question. You know, of course, we're just interpreting the Constitution here. I'm sure personal political philosophy has nothing to do with it, right?
And Ohio's not alone here. I mean, other states are in the same position, and it's a sort of a two-pronged strategy the opponents of these kind of bans are pursuing. One is to try and get the ban overturned either through the state legislature or at the ballot box. States like Minnesota have done this. But also at the same time going through the courts. And, you know, we have seen other rulings in other states starting to chip away at this idea of what is the constitutional provision or what constitutional limits on enforcing, you know, particularly gay marriage bans. So, you know, it'll be interesting what prevails. There's some thought out there that the courts are going to beat the ballot in some cases, you know, because as Karen was saying, you can sort of debate on the political strategy of when's the right time if you're opposed to the ban or even supporting it for that matter of going to the ballot. But in the interim, the courts might intervene. I think there is a thought that this might be one of those issues that gets to the Supreme Court and, you know, decides it once and for all without these individual state battles.
And then you have people like Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio. His son came out a little over a year ago. And as a supporter of gay marriage, says it would be a whole lot better if voters decided this rather than have the court impose it. And he talks about, you know, Roe v. Wade and how that's been just a hot controversy for all these decades, at least in part, because a court imposed that.
Mm-hmm. You mean and have the voters, but it'd have to be a state by state.
Right, right. It would be. But, you know, in particular, the voters of Ohio declare that. Now, again, we don't know how it would even play out in Ohio. And again, you put two more years onto the calendar. As Karen says, to be blunt, some of the old people who are more likely to be opponents are going to die off. Some younger people are going to come of voting age. And that demographic will shift. But there's also been, it's not like that's all that's happening here. People are changing their minds on this issue. Again, love it or hate it, it is happening.
And it is historical, how fast it's happening.
Oh, no question. I mean, you look at, you know, whatever controversy of the day there is, abortion or death penalty. Certainly those have been in the news a lot recently and in the recent years. There's really been not that much of a change in public opinion on those controversial issues. But gay marriage, you know, this was just, still, actually, less than 10 years ago, Ohioans, voted against gay marriage 62-38%. An overwhelming, crushing defeat for gay marriage. And now, 9.5 years later, we're talking about it's at least even, and who knows, we actually vote on it.
And it's an interesting how far it's gone, too, because you take, for example, in Indiana, they had a question before the legislature on, you know, putting a gay marriage ban into their constitution. There was going to be a ballot issue. And there was a big fight against it by the business community there. And in some cases, pretty, you know, staunchly aligned with, you know, Republican constituencies. But the argument was by a couple of big companies in particular that this was bad for business, that this would hurt the ability of businesses to keep and attract workers if we have sort of this ban on marriage to the extent that it mattered to employees, and a willingness to step forward and, in these cases, business, say, okay, we're opposed to this and we're going to put money against it, even if that offends some of our customers who do support the ban on gay marriage. So Daryl's right, just an amazing shift in a pretty short period of time.
Another shift has been in the regards to marijuana laws, medical marijuana. There's a big front page story on the Dispatch today about medical marijuana and what it can do and how it can help people, at least according to some studies and that sort of thing. Is that roughly paralleling? Is that a verb? Does that roughly does a change in attitude about that parallel?
I don't think that shift has been quite to the extent. Now, again, I think we've all heard of what's happened in Colorado. You know, the Rocky Mountain High has become real 40 years after John Denver saying it. You know, Oregon, various other states at various stages. I'm not seeing that happening in Ohio in the next couple, 3 years at least. But that's more of a guess than anything solid. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I don't see a legislative move, certainly as long as the Republicans are in control like they are today.
Right. And I think, you know, I was talking to Tracy Plock, who's the head of the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, about the efforts to try to deal with the heroin problem that Ohio's been having and the record numbers of overdoses and the programs the state is trying to work on with regard to trying to keep kids away from these drugs. And, you know, I specifically asked her, does marijuana and the talk about legalizing even medicinal marijuana, how does that play into it? And she said that she felt like it really kind of hurts the message that they're trying to send. There are a lot of people that really do feel that marijuana is a gateway drug, and so to talk about legalizing marijuana while at the same time you're talking about staying away from heroin and painkillers and that sort of thing is a mixed message. At least some people feel it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's right that you're not going to see legislatures do it. It's going to be, if it's going to happen, it's going to be by the ballot. And even in Colorado, you know, the governor was opposed to it. All the institutional folks were opposed to it, and it was approved by the voters. That's how it got implemented there.
In fact, that, of course, is recreational use of marijuana.
Right, right. And there is a lower bar for approval of medicinal marijuana, and you have seen some states on their own do that. They'll approve either decriminalizing, you know, marijuana or allowing certain amounts for medicinal purposes. So there might be some debate there, but I don't think with this current legislature, for sure, you're not going to see that happen.
Now we should add that there has been an ongoing petition process. And, right. In fact, I've gotten some news releases. I think they're going to be at polling places tomorrow gathering signatures. Now, that's been a very slow signature-gathering process for the pro-marijuana crowd. You know, insert your joke there if you wish. But, you know, it is a fairly steep bar to qualify for the ballot. But there is an active effort ongoing. We'll see whether they get to the threshold or not. Almost 400,000 valid signatures.
Let's move on to another drug issue, and that's regarding the drugs they use in state executions in the state of Ohio. They said that the inmate, Dennis McGuire, was executed using a couple drugs, and now the state's saying that he didn't have enough of those drugs in him, and that's why witnesses saw what they saw when he appeared to be struggling and so forth. They're saying he didn't experience pain during the execution, so they're just going to use the same drugs but in higher doses in the future. There is this whole issue of the method of execution has really gotten mixed up in the issue of the death penalty.
Yeah, and it's gotten worse, obviously, last week where we had the
Oklahoma.
Botched execution in Oklahoma.
Right.
And the problem is, you know, states have moved to lethal injection as the form of execution. We have 32 states that allow the death penalty right now. And believe it or not, there's actually 35 that have lethal injection as their form of execution because they've abolished the death penalty but still have people on death row who are, you know, not being exonerated for their death penalty execution. But, you know, the issue has been that, you know, the drugs that states have relied on over time reliably to do these executions by lethal injections, they can't get anymore because big manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies have said, we don't want our drugs used to kill people. It makes the drugs harder to get. In some cases, states can get them from other states. But we're in this position now where states are sort of being forced to experiment. What is the right kind of combination cocktail of drugs that should be used to execute a person, and what's the correct dosage? And it's almost like a trial and error thing where Ohio had an execution that you mentioned. It was the first one with this particular combination and dosage amount. Well, there was some question of whether that was adequate, so they're changing that protocol. Oklahoma used a three-drug cocktail. There's questions about whether it was the drugs or the way they administered, you know, the drugs that was a problem there. But you have sort of these states sort of watching each other now trying to say, okay, is our protocol the right one or is one that works somewhere else the one we should think about doing? And at the same time trying to, like, get their hands on some of these drugs because it's, you know, it's becoming increasingly more difficult for states to just go to a manufacturer and get them. They have to go to what are called compound pharmacies, you know, pharmacies that would make the drugs to make them available. And, you know, there's questions about the reliability of that product as well. And, you know, it's gotten so bad. There was testimony in Missouri that the State Department of Corrections there actually paid a couple of guards $8,000 to drive to Oklahoma to get the drugs they needed for an execution in Missouri. I mean, that's what it's come to.
Yeah, it seems really rinky-dink. And there was one state recently that said they wouldn't say where they got their drugs from
that's
because
the
they
issue.
Didn't want that. That was a Missouri
Well, actually, there's several states now that
they won't say because they don't want anyone hogging or
right, or
horning
they don't
in
want it,
on their supply,
and they don't want it to be used for litigation to try and get somebody to stay in execution. So that's going to be another issue that's going to be front and center in this debate is what is the ability of a state to not disclose either what drugs being used or what amounts or even some of the other protocols that are part of the death penalty.
Kieran Kassler, can you even imagine the states not having to disclose what they're using?
No. I mean, this is a really basic state function, the function of carrying out the most serious penalty that a judge and a jury can deliver. And I can't believe that anybody would try to make that argument that these drugs are secret for whatever reason. It's mind-blowing to me because this is a process that has traditionally been pretty open in terms of having media witnesses there and being very upfront about what's happening because it is such a serious penalty. And when you start attaching secrecy to it, I think that makes it very, very suspicious, and it makes me very nervous. I mean, it should be said that in the Oklahoma execution, one of the drugs that was used in that three-drug combination is one of the drugs that is used in Ohio, though in the Oklahoma situation, it was used in a much, much larger concentration than it is in the Ohio executions. We have a little time now before the next execution in Ohio, since the one that was supposed to happen this month has been completely, clemency has been granted. It had nothing to do with the execution process. So there's a little more time to work out exactly what's going to happen here in Ohio.
Yeah, Karen's right. In Oklahoma, they used 100 milligrams of the drug. It's midazolam. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
And in Ohio, it used 10 milligrams in the execution in January, and now they're upping it to 50. So that's half of what Oklahoma used. And Florida uses 500 milligrams of this same drug. So again, it's one of these issues where states are sort of trial and error and almost looking at each other and what is the right amount and what's going to work here.
Right. And that's and you said how that's the methodology sort of gotten rolled into the death penalty debate. And of course, you know, the constitutional prohibition is cruel and unusual punishment. Again, not that anyone necessarily has all this mercy on these killers, who obviously their victims suffered much, much worse. That's, in theory, not supposed to be the issue for a civilized society. But, you know, my colleague Alan Johnson, who witnessed that last execution in Ohio and the guy's, you know, struggling and, you know, snoring or whatever, whether he's conscious or not, we don't know, witnessed earlier ones where they couldn't find a vein. They're poking a guy with needle with, you know, so they could administer fatal drugs. That is one side. Then the other side is, are there innocent folks there or folks who don't deserve this penalty? Karen referred to the most recent prisoner. We had an execution scheduled for later this month. It's not happening now because first the parole board found that not only should he not be executed, he should go free. And the majority said right now.
And he was next in line.
Right. He was within, you know, just a little over a month of being executed. All his legal appeals had been filed because to get an execution date in Ohio, you have to have exhausted all legal remedies. So he had nothing left except the parole board. And then the parole board steps in, you know, not exactly bleeding heart types, by the way, right, for those who've covered it, and said, no, this guy should walk. Not just shouldn't be killed, he should be free. And it's like, wow. That I mean, that's incredible. So that adds a lot of spice to this debate.
Now, it should be said that the governor didn't agree and that he's not going to be completely freed from prison. But it does bring up the whole question that Justice Paul Pfeiffer, who helped write the death penalty statute, and others have talked about this whole idea of this death lottery. Depending on where you committed the crime, that really determines whether you're more or less likely to be sentenced to death for it. And that's the implementation of the death penalty in the state has got a lot of people very concerned. That also includes two former prison department directors, Reginald Wilkinson and Terry Collins.
Right.
Again, not exactly bleeding heart liberals, I don't think.
A lot of flux in that issue and others. Thank you so much for talking about it today, Kieran Kassler.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Kieran Kassler, she's Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also, Mark Niket, reporter for Bloomberg News. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Daryl, thanks again for joining us.
Good to have the team together again, Ann.
Thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.